Hello, current affairs listeners. This is Editor-in-Chief Nathan J. Robinson. We're going to get to the episode in a moment, but I just wanted to announce beforehand that you might all be interested in the current affairs writing class that is going to be held on Zoom Saturday, November 19th. This is an upcoming fundraiser for current affairs, but it's also a very practical class on how to improve your writing, how to get it published, and even how to launch independent media projects like Current Affairs. I'm going to share with all of you what I have learned and what I wish I knew when I was a freelance writer, and tickets are going to benefit Current Affairs, an independent magazine with no advertisers or investors that survives entirely through reader support. I think it's going to be a great class. You can look on Eventbrite where we're selling tickets and you can see some of the reviews we had the last time we did it. We hope you'll consider taking it. Hope to see some of you there. Thanks very much. On with the show. My name is Nathan Robinson. I am the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs Magazine. My guest today is Stephen Deal. He is a software engineer based in London. He is the co-author of the book Popping the Crypto Bubble. His writings can be found at his website, stephendeal.com. And we bring him on today because Stephen Deal is also, in some ways, a prophet. Stephen, hello. Welcome to Current Affairs. Nice to talk to you.
Hi, Nathan. Lovely to be here today.
Okay, so you've been writing about cryptocurrency for a while. And I want to just read the pretty emphatic opening sentence to your book, Popping the Crypto Bubble. Cryptocurrency is a giant scam, although a complicated scam that uses techno-babble, heterodox economics, and populist anger to obfuscate its functioning. A pitch-perfect scam for the post-truth era of social media where trust in institutions and experts is at an all-time low. So what is it that led you to or leads you to that pretty strong conclusion, cryptocurrency as a whole, giant scam?
Well, it's a conclusion I've come to over the last couple years when I've kind of looked at the space and the impact it's having on just everyday people, on the tech industry, and on the world at large. This is a technology which has an overwhelmingly malign influence on the world, all for a set of theoretical upsides which never seem to match reality or bear any fruit. So crypto really is a solution in search of a problem. And we've seen that in the last year with the collapse of most of these tokens. A lot of them are revealed to be outright scams. A lot of people in the public have gotten hurt. And unfortunately, a lot of it was very preventable. And so I tried to lay out in my book what I think is the case for why the crypto industry is selling the public on a lot of lies, because none of the things that they say make a lot of sense.
Yeah, so maybe you could elaborate on what you think the biggest of those lies or misconceptions is. What are some of the things that the industry tries to convince people of that they should not, in fact, believe?
Well, the problem with the crypto industry is that it changes its story every 6 months. So this all goes back to maybe 10, 13 years ago when the conception of Bitcoin came around. And Bitcoin originally started as a so-called peer-to-peer electronic payment system, which aimed to be a way to send value between different parties without the need for a intermediate, like a bank or payment processor. Unfortunately, it turns out that the design of Bitcoin was informed by some very strange sort of Austrian economics and kind of heterodox views about money that were baked into this design of this fixed supply. So there's only 21 million Bitcoin. So that's a really poor design for a currency. Currencies have to be dynamic. They have to adjust with the market effects, the broader economy as a whole, and money derives its value from the requirement for you to extinguish your obligations to the state in the form of taxation. Crypto has none of that. So crypto as a whole is an asset which has absolutely zero intrinsic value. The only value it's derived from is people's faith in the fact that there'll be another sucker who will buy it off of them for more than what they paid for it. That's not a sustainable thing. So crypto as money failed. It doesn't work. Ever since then, every 6 months, the industry has tried to come up with some sort of new story. It's a new version of the internet. It's a speculative investment that's uncorrelated with the broader market. It's a hedge against inflation. And all of these are wrong. None of them pass any kind of intellectual scrutiny. And they just keep coming up with new stories and new lies all over and over again with the aim to bring more suckers from the public in to buy this stuff because they want to make money off of them. And that's the big scam.
Yeah, I mean, you do say in the book that the word currency really is a misnomer here, because the things that are touted as the features of it as currency are, the things that distinguish it from the dollar, the things that make it special are actually bugs that make it unworkable as currency.
There's a joke in software engineering that, like, that's not a bug, that's a feature. So the crypto people look at, like, fiat money, like the dollar and the euro, and they see the dynamic supply, and they think that's a bug. But actually, that's a feature of money that actually makes it all work. And so they've invented this really heterodox currency that has this very strange fixed supply property, which doesn't work at all.
It's money, but without central banks. You're like, actually, they do something. You know, you mentioned Austrian economics there, and one of the interesting observations that or conclusions that you come to in the book is you say cryptocurrency is a technology built on and inseparable from right-wing philosophy. That's also the conclusion that the guy who created Dogecoin came to. He said that cryptocurrency was an inherently right-wing technology. I wonder if you could explain what you and he mean by that.
So if you look at the design of it, and you look at the original Satoshi white paper in the forums that he used to talk about, I mean, they have a very particular view about the state and its role in our daily life. They are, for the most part, like what people in Silicon Valley are, like they're called techno-libertarians. They believe that software and the internet as a whole is a means to dismantle democratic institutions and replace them with software. It's a very heterodox view. It's not very widely held outside of Silicon Valley, but it's a very popular view in that particular domain. And you see that embedded everywhere in the crypto space. These people really don't want to have institutions. They don't want to have regulation. They don't want to have laws. They don't want to have safeguards. They believe that the market and complete laissez-faire capitalism should completely dominate all of our economic life, and that basically the market is the only arbiter of anything that actually matters. And that happens to resonate with a certain branch of right-wing philosophy, especially in American politics. It's really inseparable. These people, they don't want to be regulated. They don't want to have the same kind of normal safeguards that we have around regulated financial products. And it's hard to separate the desire for the minimization of the state, a belief in complete laissez-faire capitalism, and a belief that there should be no regulation from right-wing politics.
You know, cryptocurrency is the privatization of money. And so in the same way that the privatization of the roads and the schools and the police would be inherently linked to right-wing philosophy, that is, moving these things from being in public, democratically accountable institutions into the hands of oligarchs who have mastered the markets, there is something kind of inherently right-wing about moving anything from the public sector to the private sector.
That's exactly right. I mean, they want to take the issuance of money, which has traditionally been the role of the state, And they want to privatize it. They want to have corporations issue their own private forms of money. And in the United States, we've actually tried this back in the 1800s. It was called the wildcat banking era. And spoiler, it didn't end very well. We ended up nationalizing currency for a very, very good reason, because having, you know, 5,000 different types of private issuances of money is really bad for commerce. And it's really bad for the average layperson, because they just want to buy, you know, bread and buy their socks, and like they don't have to want to have to exchange all this money and become an FX trader just to go to the grocery store.
Sure. Actually, one of the real values of your book is that you have this great section on the history of market manias, where you go through lots of different examples of that you think each of these historical examples that you choose can tell us a little something about cryptocurrency. And I think what kind of made me laugh as I was reading this is I had just read an interview with Sam Bankman-Fried, who we will talk about, where he said he didn't read books. He said, yeah, you could just put it in a blog post. I don't read books. And I thought, well, this is a really good reason to read books. Because what you've done, Stephen Deal, is you have read books on history. And so you have understood how a lot of the things that we see now have precedents and predecessors. And so perhaps you could introduce us to a couple of the examples that you bring up to try and help us understand what we see now.
Yeah, I mean, the joke about history is that it repeats itself first as tragedy, then as farce.
But what comes after farce?
Absurdism, I guess, because that's what is written right now. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. And the biggest lie in finance is that this time it's different. There have been dozens of these financial manias throughout history, going all the way back to the tulip manias in the 1600s, to the South Sea bubble in the 1700s. And you start to see a pattern if you look at the sort of cycles of history around. There are these irrational moments in markets where people become enamored with a narrative about a specific type of financial asset or a specific type of commodity. And suddenly the price of these assets becomes untethered to the base reality. And people basically pile in expecting to make money on top of this bubble, not because of any kind of intrinsic value or any kind of cash flows, because they can, you know, offload it on another pool. Back in the 1600s, people sold tulips for, like, you know, the price of a small house. And this was a market mania that lasted about 6 months. Everybody was speculating on tulips, and they developed this whole economy where they were trading, like, derivative products on top of tulips in the 1600s. And probably one of the more representative bubbles is what's called the South Sea Bubble, which was a famous mania in 1720 in England, where people created a empty shell company called the South Sea Company, which would originally have rights to do trade with in the South Sea in the Americas, which had recently been discovered at the time. Except they forgot to actually do the actual business part of it. So they were selling shares in this company that wasn't actually doing anything. And the public thought, well, this is just a great way to make money. Why don't we just go buy up these shares? Because the price just seems to be going up and up and up. And, like, let's not ask too many questions about what's going on here. And at a certain point, this consumed, like, an enormous amount of the GDP of the entire nation state of England. Like, the crown was in on it. Like, the Bank of England was piling into this thing. It had an arrangement with the government itself to buy government, like, sovereign debt. It got this massive bubble. Like, Sir Isaac Newton, one of the greatest geniuses of all time, basically lost a large chunk of his savings in the South Sea bubble. And so this was in 1720.
No one's a genius about everything.
Yeah, of course. So there's a famous book called The Extraordinary Popular Delusion and the Madness of Crowds. And it's the best book ever written about Bitcoin. And nothing has changed since then. These things have always happened. They always will happen. They're just part of markets and they're part of human madness.
I want to read a great paragraph you have on the wildcat banking, the era of private banking. You say the lessons of wildcat banking are still a stark reminder today about the failures of experiments in private money. When the public allows private accountable entities access to a money printer, They usually use it as a machine of fraud, just as much today as they did back in 1839. The Wildcat era marked an era of unnecessary friction in commerce, rampant fraud, breakdown of trust in the financial system. The historical lesson for the Wildcat banking era is that bank deposits cannot reliably act as money without bank regulation, supervision, and some form of government insurance. It's an important lesson to learn from the past, given the recent French efforts to return to a digital variant of private money with stablecoins and crypto assets. So by looking at what happened in, as you say, 1839, we are on our guard, and we don't miss or misunderstand things when they come around again, as they inevitably do.
Exactly. That's a direct quote from a bank examiner in Ohio back in the 1800s, and exactly the same kind of fraud that they were running back in the wildcat banks in the Midwest at the time is happening today with stablecoins. Turns out when you give people an infinite money machine, what do they use it for? To enrich themselves. It's very, it's very indicative of human nature that if there's no safeguards on what you can do with other people's money, chances are you're going to run away with it.
But you also say it's not just these... There's the South Sea Bubble, the Tulip Bubble, but you also say that we can even learn from looking at the Enron scandal, looking at Beanie Babies, looking at the 2007-2008 financial crisis. Each one of these, you sort of enumerate how each one of these teaches us something about cryptocurrency.
Yeah, so crypto's like synthesizes different facets of all these manias from the past into this sort of mega frothy bubble. Which draws on a lot of different scandals. We can learn from the Enron scandal about how creative accounting can be used to obscure all sorts of problems, just like we saw with the latest FTX collapse. We can learn from Beanie Babies about how commodities can become untethered from their fundamental value and how even clever people can get swept away in the mania. We can learn from the savings and loan crisis and the market crash of 1929. There's a lot of lessons that history has to tell us about these things, and it's not even that far back. I mean, we're talking about a few hundred years, and there's a lot of wisdom baked into our current regulation and markets that was paid for by a lot of our ancestors, by our grandparents, and they put these things in for a very good reason. And the securities framework that was put in place back in the 1920s, after the Great Depression, is the very thing that the crypto industry is fighting with at the moment. And there's a lot of parallels between the speculative mania that led to the Great Depression and what's happening in securities evasion in the crypto market today.
The reason that I have brought you on today in particular, I've read your writing for a long time, and you're part of the reason that I ended up looking into this and writing an article called Why Cryptocurrency is a Giant Fraud. Your book is excellent, came out a few months ago, but the things that you have been writing for a long time have become super relevant in the last couple of weeks because there has been a colossal, perhaps the largest or most sudden collapse in the crypto industry in the history of, a long series of sudden catastrophic collapses, which is the demise of the cryptocurrency exchange, FTX. Sam Bankman-Fried, who the CEO, was profiled in many major, in the New York Times, in Fortune magazine, in Forbes, in Bloomberg, and was kind of the ambassador, the respectable ambassador for cryptocurrency in Washington, and a major proponent of the effective altruism movement, who was this big do-gooder who said, who was putting out this respectable face of cryptocurrency. Well, in the last... within a couple of days, the entire enterprise collapsed. His $16 billion fortune fell apart, and it seems as if the company was built on surprise, surprise, big fraud. So let's first, perhaps you could give us, actually, perhaps you could tell us a little bit first about crypto exchanges, because you have like FTX, because you have a whole chapter in the book about these, about crypto exchanges and what they do.
So crypto exchanges are the entry points by which people take their actual money and they use it to buy crypto tokens. So at least on face value, these are businesses which you can connect to through like a web portal, and they offer you the capacity to connect your credit card or your bank account and purchase these crypto assets. That's how it works in principle. What actually happens is that these things, well, typically they're set up in very dodgy ways, typically offshore from the United States, like outside of financial regulation. So typically they will go shop around for a jurisdiction, which generally is very lax about financial regulation. Oftentimes these things are set up in like tax shelters where wealthy people hide their money, and where they can basically buy off the regulators to basically let them to do whatever they want. And the thing to understand is that the entire world's banking system is already connected. So people in the United States, in Europe, in Britain, right, they can wire money to these entities abroad, and then their money is basically held by a corporation that exists in this offshore tax haven, which can do whatever they want. And allegedly, some of them actually offer services for their customers, but they don't act like a normal exchange, like a Fidelity or like a Charles Schwab that actually, you know, takes your money, allows you to buy like actual stocks. What they do is they take your money and then you have like a unsecured creditor arrangement with this offshore entity of which you have no standing in that jurisdiction, in which they have absolutely no requirement to deliver you anything. And they basically let you buy crypto assets. They basically operate as like a casino or like what would traditionally be called like a bucket shop. And these businesses can get away with a lot of really, really shady things. And because a lot of the crypto assets are illegal to sell in the United States, people are forced to go abroad to these offshore, basically like casino boats operating these, you know, tax shelters to buy these assets that they want to gamble on. And the latest one was this company called FTX, which is run by this American chap named Sam Bankman-Fried, which was allegedly one of the more respectable of the, that should tell you enough right there, actually. Exchanges that was doing this massive marketing campaign in the United States, trying to get all these customers and like trying to lobby Congress to get regulation. And it turns out the entire thing was basically operating to first approximation like a giant Ponzi scheme. And what always happens with Ponzi schemes is that Ponzi schemes are insolvent from the start. And what's some point when outflows exceed inflows, they collapse. There's a lot of sound and fury about what went on inside of that collapse, but at the base level, like there was just not enough money to go around because they were basically siphoning it off to this other entity, which is basically operating as a hedge fund and using it to gamble on even riskier things. And that means that basically everybody that was putting their money on this exchange is now basically an unsecured creditor of some Bahamian shell company, which is now insolvent. And that's really bad. A lot of people got hurt.
Yeah, I mean, they had ads in the Super Bowl. This was the Larry David ad.
It's FTX. It's a safe and easy way to get into crypto.
Yeah, I don't think so. And I'm never wrong about this stuff. Never.
They bought naming rights to some stadium. You know, I tweeted recently that I think this is just as much a story about the failure of financial journalism than as it is the failure of this company, because I think to the extent that people trusted this institution, which in the Super Bowl ad, they had said, oh, it's a safe way to get into crypto. And to the extent that people did not realize that giving your money to, I think he's a 28-year-old in the Bahamas, with a, you know, to put money into magic beans, right? But to the extent that they thought, oh no, this guy's good for it, it is in part because there are all these newspaper stories touting him as a brilliant genius and altruist who is the future of finance, and maybe he'll buy Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan.
You're exactly right on that. It is baffling to me that we have all of these, you know, seemingly respectable institutions. The credulity of them is staggering. They are treating this thing, which anybody who does due diligence on any kind of company, this thing is papered in red flags. It is a Bahamian, you know, shell company set up in the least regulated environment on the planet and with no board of directors, no governments, completely opaque financials, right? Set up by a 28-year-old and apparently staffed by like, you know, 17 kids all living in a frat house in the Bahamas. Like, you couldn't make this stuff up. And the story just keeps getting more and more absurd the day it's on. But like the investors in this thing were some of the most sophisticated funds on the planet. Like these are nobody's fools. This is the biggest Sand Hill Road investors in Silicon Valley, you know, SoftBank, Tiger Global. And apparently none of them did any due diligence on this thing. And the story just gets more strange and more strange. And it just speaks to like what happens in this like super low interest rate environment where there's so much money sloshing around the United States chasing too few things that people are just so desperate to get into deals that they're willing to say, like, well, I like this chap, Sam. He seems respectable, and there's nothing else to put my money in, so let's just let it ride. That's really what this is.
I was struck by, I don't know if you read the interview that Mr. Bankman-Fried did with Matt Levine of Bloomberg a while back, but Levine is a pretty sharp guy who writes the Bloomberg's Money Stuff newsletter, and he asked Bankman-Fried to describe this thing that I don't quite understand called yield farming, and Bankman-Fried describes it, and he sort of begins, well, imagine you have kind of a worthless thing, but everyone starts believing in it. And Matt Levine of Bloomberg reacts by saying, well, it sounds like you're saying I'm in the Ponzi business, and that business is good. And Bankman-Fried replies, well, that there's some validity to that. Now, Levine, interestingly, because I subscribe to his newsletter, it says today, he still says, when he heard that, he actually, his trust in Bankman-Fried increased rather than decreased, because he thought, well, this guy at least kind of knows what he's doing. He's not like a religious believer. You describe how a lot of these people are very like, you know, they have this kind of mystical view of how cryptocurrency will save us all. No, he understands. He's a real cynic. But it was shocking to me that the guy could sort of acknowledge in a public forum that the word Ponzi was not inapplicable to his line of work. And it didn't seem to register with anyone, including the sophisticated financial journalist who is interviewing him.
That interview, actually, it's on the Odd Lots podcast on Bloomberg, was surreal. So Matt Levine, very clever chap. He writes this column every week in Bloomberg, and he's one of the wittiest and most, I would say, just brilliant mind in journalism. And he interviewed Sam Bankman-Fried and asked him to describe what his line of business was investing in these DeFi protocols. And the description that he gave was like, okay, imagine a box. We put money in the box. We all believe really hard, and then more money comes out of the box than we put in. And that was the essence of what was going on. And like Matt Levine turns to him and says, like, what you're describing is that you're in the Ponzi business, and it's pretty good. And Sam just like confesses on Bloomberg, yes, I'm in the Ponzi business, and it's great. And you know, he basically confessed to running a Ponzi scheme on Bloomberg, and everybody was like, well, that's just the norm now. And then, you know, basically 6 months later, the entire thing exploded. I'm not quite sure what to make of this phenomenon because, you know, at the same time, like, these journalists do their best to kind of expose, like, what's going on here. It's just the public doesn't seem to care. They want to invest in the Ponzi scheme. The fact that it's a Ponzi is actually a feature to them, right? And what do you do as a financial journalist in those kind of circumstances where, you know, people are going into this with like somewhat clear eyes and they're choosing to invest in these things that they know are financially unstable? And how do you cover this thing? So I've talked with a lot of financial journalists, and a lot of them have basically taken this sort of like, I just report the facts and figures on this stuff. I don't have an opinion. And it's sort of taboo to even talk about. A lot of financial journalists prefer not to talk about this stuff because, like, you know, I went to, you know, Yale to study journalism for 8 years, and I'm forced to cover, you know, assets whose only intrinsic value is a meme of a talking dog. It's kind of an affront.
Yes.
And that's really where we're at. I mean, the public doesn't care what the journalists write, and the journalists don't know how to cover it. And then the public basically is left with this very imperfect information. It's very much a symptom of this kind of post-truth era, though. Like, people just don't care.
And it would be amusing if not for headlines like some teacher's pension fund was invested in FTX. You know, that's real people. That's not just like dumb crypto bros who buy cartoon apes.
Yeah, I mean, like, just, you know, despite all the like the schadenfreude we might have about like some of these like really wealthy hedge funds, you know, getting wiped out. I mean, that's always funny. Like watching wealthy people destroy themselves is good fun. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, most of the money that's flowing into crypto is not coming from these hedge funds. It's coming from everyday moms and dads. These are just normal salt of the earth people. Like, imagine your canonical crypto investor is just some, you know, some mom in the NHS that said, you know, her grandson convinced her, like, oh, you should put, you know, $200 in crypto. And then she lost it all. You know, that could mean a lot of money to her. And that's the people that are being suckered into this stuff. So, you know, this isn't just some abstract financial game played by hedge funds. This is real money, real people losing real money that they can't afford to lose because they're being told by celebrities, they're being told by influencers, they're being told by some financial journalists that this is the future and you have to get in now. Unfortunately, none of that story makes any sense. And that's the big problem with crypto, is that it hurts real people.
Is it the case that the story of FTX, the Sam Bankman-Fried story, is a story of the inherent unsolvable problems with the crypto space? Or is it the case that we have a fraudster who nobody knew was a fraudster? When I said, a lot of us have been saying this is, all crypto is a scam for a while, someone came back and said, well, you know, a lot of people didn't know that he was, how could we possibly have known that this guy was not doing what he said he was doing? He was actually taking his customers' assets and placing risky bets with them. Well, he told us he wasn't doing that. Now, he turned out to be doing it. You could say, well, that's why we need transparency and regulation. Sure. But is it the case? Because I think one of the arguments that you make in the book is that there is no way to make crypto non-Ponzi-like. And I think what someone who was defending it, and I think even what Matt Levine still says, is that no, Bankman-Fried was not saying that he runs a Ponzi scheme. He was saying that he sort of facilitates a lot of other people's Ponzi schemes, and that his business didn't have to be a fraud. It didn't have to come tumbling down. Now, it did come tumbling down, but we can imagine a world with a more honest broker and more. Now, for example, there's another crypto exchange, Binance, now, or Binance, I don't know how you pronounce it, but whatever it is, the big one that killed FTX, are they inevitably going to collapse? Or maybe if they're run by a more honest broker, could they have stable facilitation for a much longer time of something that keeps functioning without these terrible collapses?
So Binance is papered in all of the red flags that FTX was, and then some. I mean, this is one that is even more opaque than FTX. It has no presence to any regulation. In fact, they're actually illegal in my country, in Britain. They've been completely banned. This is the same with several other countries. They cannot operate in the United States. This is a company which makes FTX look like the Easter Bunny. This is a company like really, really opposed to regulation in any form, set up in the most shadowy parts of the financial system with absolutely no oversight, and a CEO who is the most like unapologetic nihilist that will just do whatever it takes to achieve his end goal. He is very Machiavellian. So I would not hold up Binance to be the shining example of what will save us. But to go back to your question, like people often push back on me and say, you can't say that crypto is all a scam. You have to take a more moderate position. Maybe it's just a tool, right? Well, you have to ask, what is the tool being used for? And we could ask this from an intellectual perspective, like what is crypto useful for? Well, okay, it's not money. It's not building a new financial system, because it doesn't actually function as money. You can't build anything on top of it that can be used for commerce. It's not building a new internet. It's not a hedge against inflation. It's not an uncorrelated asset. So what is it? Like the only comparable thing you can kind of compare it to is like art. So art like is a thing which has some sort of conceptual or aesthetic value that people can sell basically to another fool. So imagine a piece of artwork chopped up into 21 million pieces that people just trade, right? And if it was just that, I actually wouldn't have a lot of problems with it. If it was just basically a piece of like libertarian performance art, kind of like that Banksy, where they chopped it up into like different pieces at auction, right? If crypto is basically just the version of the financial version of Banksy, I wouldn't care. Except it happens to be this performance art that has all of this negative externality, which is screwing so many people over. Which has all of these climate implications, geopolitical implications. It's used for sanctions evasion, for dark markets, for, you know, human trafficking, for terrorism financing. So it's not a harmless thing that people have going on here. It's not just, you know, high net worth individuals fighting over a Picasso. And so when you deconstruct all of the narratives, none of them actually make sense. And when you treat it as basically this sort of, you know, speculative digital commodity, you have to look at, like, what's the actual outcome? And from a pure consequentialist perspective, most people are going to get hurt by this. And so I think it's extremely fair to call it a scam because it just doesn't work. And it has all this horrible thing associated with it, its existence.
Yeah. And one of the things that you argue is that there is never going to be stability. The Ponzi-ish nature of cryptocurrency, because it's built on nothing, because it depends so heavily on faith. You say, I'm going to quote you here. So you say, bubbles need to be fed and bubbles cannot sustain themselves with stable inflows. Under the rational bubble model, a crypto asset can only be an economic black hole investment on long timescales, requiring increasing capital to be fed to sustain its ultimately unstable and transient existence. Could you explain what you mean by an economic black hole?
Okay, so if you want to treat crypto as an investment, you have to ask the fundamental question, where is the money going to come from, right? So everybody knows at least one person that became a crypto millionaire, right? And you have to ask the question, like, where did that money come from? Well, it came from like 10,000 other suckers, right? And the only reason people are investing in these things is because they want to get more dollars. They want to flip their crypto tokens around to a greater fool. There is no other source of income associated with a crypto asset. Like, a Bitcoin doesn't produce anything. It's not like you know, a house, which can generate rent. Or it's not like a stock where there's actually a company that sells something.
It produces CO2 emissions.
Okay, yes, it has externalities, which are negative as well. But there's no cash that flows into a Bitcoin, right? It's a pure, what's called a greater fool asset, which means that if you're trying to treat this as an investment, the only money that comes to pay out people who sell ultimately comes from new investors paying out old investors, which is exactly the same economics as a Ponzi scheme. And if you just look at the base economics of this thing, it'll never function as money because imagine there's a fixed supply and there's variable demand because people are treating it as a speculative investment. Well, okay, price is the equilibrium between supply and demand from economics 101, and you have variable demand and fixed supply where you can have variable price. And so basically crypto exists and will always function as this basically random oscillator that will just bubble up and down at random based on wild sentiment in the market. And that looks like a casino rather than an actual market because there's no goods or services actually being exchanged in this process. It's basically just the equivalent of a roulette wheel.
Yeah, I think, you know, I previously interviewed Molly White and Nicholas Weaver, who I believe co-signed the letter with you that was written to Congress about cryptocurrency regulation. And one of the things that came up in those interviews was when you see all of the ads, when you see, and also the kind of culture that has developed around crypto, where people are, you know, where those who ask questions are treated as idiots who just don't understand. You need to remember that in the case of a bubble, and the case of an asset where people are depending on the greater fool theory, someone is trying to suck you in because they need to keep finding new suckers. And so when you look at that ad, remember that the sucker might be you.
That is exactly right. I mean, the reason they're taking out Super Bowl ads, the reason they're putting their names on stadiums, the reason every time I ride the tube in London, there's an advertisement for some, you know, buy my dog coin today, right? It's because they just need more inflows of money to pay out old investors. And that's exactly how Ponzi schemes work. It's just a very strange one because it's sort of like, Nicholas Weaver is actually a brilliant chap. I know you've interviewed him as well. He calls it a self-assembled Ponzi scheme because it differs from the classical Ponzi scheme in some very strange ways because there's no central operator on it. It's basically run on a kind of decentralized marketplace online where people like construct the Ponzi's themselves, which is very bizarre. And if there is any actual innovation in crypto, it's the fact that like any teenager can create a self-assembled Ponzi scheme overnight, sometimes accidentally. And that's what's happening.
We didn't get flying cars, but the future does have the democratization of the Ponzi. One of the things you do in the book really, really well is also, again, because you read books and you study history and culture, you don't even talk about like Scientology and the way that religions and cults kind of work, and how we can spot irrationalism in crypto culture.
There's a whole chapter in the book, it's called The Cult of Crypto, which describes my best attempt at describing kind of the sociology of people who are in deep inside the crypto space. And I think it's important to kind of caveat this by saying not everybody in crypto is in this cult, but the cult definitely exists. And these people have some very, very strange beliefs that border on what I would call kind of like a secular religion. They really believe that this technology is going to usher in some new golden era for mankind. And it's going to lead to, you know, the dissolution of the nation state and the overthrow of the dollar, and the, you know, the entire international order is going to collapse and give rise to this, techno-anarchist utopia, in which they're going to be basically god kings. And they believe this sincerely. Like, they literally will write entire like diatribes about how they're going to have like citadels full of all of their anarchist friends, and they're all going to be living in this like crypto utopia. And they always lack the details about how that society would actually ever work. But, you know, alas, they really do believe it. And for some people, unfortunately, there's a lot of lost young people who are, you know, economically disenfranchised. And this narrative is speaking to something deep inside of them that they're not finding elsewhere in our society.
Yeah, I mean, I read that little bit from your intro where you say, you know, this era with the low trust in institutions and experts, also a time of great inequality, everyone grasping at hope, people looking for meaning in their lives. It certainly appeals to that. I suppose we should just finish here by asking, in the wake of the FTX collapse and the discrediting of the most respectable ambassador for crypto, effective altruist billionaire Sam Bankman-Fried, what would your advice to Congress be on what should be done next in order to, I mean, you're in the UK, but there's a lot of discussion in the United States about how policy should respond. Some people would say, well, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but you say in the book, it's all bathwater, there is no baby. Or perhaps if there is a baby, it's a demon baby that shouldn't survive. If a legislator sat down with you and said, Stephen Diehl, tell me what we ought to do, what the optimum response here is post-FTX, what would you tell them?
So last year, I drafted a letter and got 1,500 people in my industry to sign what was called the concern.tech letter. I think the points that we made in that letter are very clear. We don't want Congress to carve out a specific bespoke regulatory regime for crypto assets. These are products which are deeply predatory. They have no clear economic use case other than pure naked speculation. They come attached with all of these climate externalities, all of these investor protection externalities. And after 13 years, there's still a solution in search of the problem. Crypto is the same age as the iPhone. And imagine if the iPhone, and we're still, you know, like scratching our heads, being like, what's the phone for? Right? You know, we're still asking these fundamental existential questions after 14 years. That's a big red flag. And so for Congress, what they really need to do is really just enforce the laws on the books. So there's this piece of legislation that our grandparents put into place in the 1920s called the Securities Act, which outlines how joint stock companies can be made and what kind of disclosures and investor protections have to be put around the sale of things that look like what are called securities. So securities are abstract financial instruments that people can trade that represent some ownership in something. And so crypto assets are securities, full stop. The US has more or less declared this to be the case in the courts, and which means they fall under the remit of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Unfortunately, the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States is very kind of like tiptoeing around this issue and not enforcing the law as it's written. A lot of these exchanges are basically operating as illegal securities marketplaces, and the SEC apparently doesn't have anything to say about that. But if they did, that would curtail a lot of the harm. So really, Congress doesn't need to do anything other than get the SEC to just do their jobs. If you just enforce the laws as they're written and declare crypto assets to be securities, a lot of the negative externalities and harms to the American public would basically just go away. And that's really just what I want to see. I just want to see the laws as they're written enforced, and that people to be protected so they don't get screwed like they do with FTX. Because all of this was very preventable. FTX could have been shut down years ago, and we've just collectively as a society allowed it to exist. And it doesn't have to be that way.
One tiny final question. The book has an epigraph: what is easy and what is right rarely coincide. Why'd you choose that particular quote?
So I'm probably the most reluctant crypto skeptic ever. I only go off and write this stuff and do it because I feel like I have a sort of obligation to do it, because I don't think there's an abundance of people that have the kind of the means, the capacity, the reach, and just the security in life to do this. And it's a really hard thing, becoming a crypto skeptic. I get so much harassment. I get so many death threats, just to basically warn people who won't listen. And that's a really hard thing, but I do it anyways, because I feel like I have a civic responsibility to kind of at least warn as many people as I can. And albeit that's hard, it's still worth doing.
Yeah, and also, of course, the get-rich-quick schemes are the easy over the difficult. The ideology, the kind of religious ideology, you know, thinking through it is not necessarily easy. Piercing bad arguments is not necessarily easy. And so what I like about what you do and what Molly does and what Nicholas Weaver does is, you know, you're the people who have the deep knowledge, who read the books to help us actually understand what is going on here and keep people from getting preyed upon. So, Stephen Deal, thank you so much for joining us. The book that you have co-authored is available. It is Popping the Crypto Bubble: Market Mania's Phony Populism and Techno Solutionism. I think every economics class should assign this book. It's really, really clearly written, helps, you know, goes through the history of manias, helps you really understand how financial markets work. It's really, really worth reading, even if you don't have actually that much interest in crypto. So thank you, Stephen Deal, for joining us on Current Affairs.
Thanks, Jason. Lovely to be here today.
The Current Affairs Podcast is a product of Current Affairs Magazine. If you are not subscribed to Current Affairs Magazine, visit currentaffairs.org/subscribe today and get our glorious print edition. The Current Affairs Podcast is released regularly every week on patreon.com/currentaffairs. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.